Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the AHRQ Quality Indicators Toolkit webinar. Today's program is being recorded. At this time, I would like to hand things over to Ms. Missy Danforth. Please go ahead, ma'am.
Thank you so much. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you so much for joining us. LeapFrog's very happy to host this webinar with presenters from AHRQ, RAND, and Harborview Medical Center today. As many of you know, since June 2012, LeapFrog has been issuing a biannual hospital safety score, which is a composite safety score represented as an A, B, C, D, or F letter grade. That composite includes 28 different national measures of patient safety, including 6 patient safety indicators that are included in the AHRQ Quality Indicators Toolkit that will be talked about today. In addition to our use of the indicators in the hospital safety score, so many of the hospitals participating in the LeapFrog Hospital Survey are realizing the importance of these measures as they appear in both CMS's Inpatient Quality Reporting Program and the HAC Reduction Program. We thought this presentation would be an excellent opportunity for the hospitals that we all work with to learn more, not just about the indicators themselves, but really what tools are available from AHRQ for hospitals for the purposes of improvement. I'm going to immediately turn the presentation over to Jan Del Mar from AHRQ. She's going to provide you all with the context for developing the QI toolkit, and she's also going to introduce the remainder of our speakers for today. As a reminder for everyone on the call, this is being recorded. Next week, we will send out a copy of the recording along with a copy of the slides presented today. Thank you very much.
Great. Thanks, Missy. And on behalf of ARC, I'd like to thank the LeapFrog group for giving us this opportunity to talk a little bit about the QI toolkit. I'm also joined today by my ARC colleague, Joanna Jane, who has been involved in the development of the QI toolkit since its inception. So just by way of brief background, ARC has been producing a set of quality indicators for hospitals for more than a decade now. And these indicators are designed to help hospitals to first identify potential areas or concerns about quality and safety that may need further study, and then second, to track performance in these areas over time. So several years ago, the agency also saw the need to provide not just indicators of quality and safety, but also tools to help hospitals to improve their performance in these areas. And so with this goal in mind, ARC funded RAND, working in collaboration with UHC, to develop the QI toolkit. And the first version was released about 2 years ago. The toolkit has just been updated. If you haven't had a chance to take a look at it recently, it's available on the ARC website at the link provided here. And if we can go to the next slide. This afternoon, we have a terrific panel of speakers who will walk you through the toolkit and talk about how you can use it to improve quality and safety in your hospital. Dr. Peter Hussey is a senior policy researcher and the director of Health Services Delivery Program at RAND. Peter was also part of the RAND team that developed the original ARC QI toolkit, and he continues to co-lead the project and oversees the development of a new pediatric toolkit, which is now underway. You'll hear a little bit about that in the presentation. Next, we'll hear from Dr. Courtney Gedangle, who is a physician scientist at RAND. She practices at Boston Children's Hospital, specializing in pediatric infectious diseases. And Courtney has expertise in pediatric safety and quality and co-leads the QI toolkit work with Peter Hussey. And then we'll be delighted to hear from Ellen Robinson, who is also joining us today. For the last 5 years, Ellen has been working as a manager and clinical quality analyst in quality improvement at Harborview Medical Center in Seattle, Washington. She also has 14 years of previous experience as a physical therapist at Harborview in the trauma ICU and trauma acute care. And if we can go to the next slide, here's the order that we're going to be following this afternoon. Peter Hussey and Courtney Gedangle will kick things off with an overview of the QI toolkit. And then after their presentation, We'll have just 5 to 10 minutes or so for quick clarifying questions about their presentation, and then we'll ask that you hold other questions and comments until our discussion portion. And then we'll hear from Ellen Robinson, who will share her experience using the toolkit at Harborview. And after Ellen's presentation, we'll open it up for discussion with all of you. And finally, you'll see there at the bottom of this slide that we're always interested in hearing about your experience using the toolkit. We'd love to get your feedback, so please email us at the address here to let us know how it's working for you. And with that, Peter, I will pass it to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Jan, and thanks to the LeapFrog group for having us here, and most of all, thanks to everyone who's in attendance today. We're excited for this opportunity to share the toolkit with you and talk about how it might be useful at your hospitals. Can everybody see my slides okay?
Yes, thanks, Peter.
Okay, thank you. So I'll start us off with an introduction to the toolkit and how it was developed, and then I'll hand it off to my colleague, Courtney Gudengo, who will go into some more depth on the tools in the toolkit and how they can be used. Okay, so the toolkit is a set of tools that hospitals can use in quality improvement, including quality and patient safety. They were designed for use with the ARC quality indicators, but they could also be used with other quality indicators as well. We designed them to be targeted for a wide range of different types of hospitals, so independent hospitals, system-affiliated hospitals, those with varying sizes and rural, urban, and different quality improvement expertise. So it was really designed to be quite flexible in trying to meet various needs that hospitals have. I'm sorry, I'm just having a hard time advancing the slide for a moment. There we go. Apologize for that. As Jan mentioned, these were developed with support from ARC through the ARC's Action Program, and we partnered with UHC. UHC is an alliance of academic medical centers and their affiliated hospitals, and they're quite active in collaborative activities to improve performance. So they've been a great partner for us in both developing and testing this toolkit. As I mentioned, the hospital is designed to be applicable for hospitals with varying needs, and so to do that, we designed it as a quote-unquote resource inventory from which hospitals can select the tools that they need. So it's not designed so that you have to start at the beginning and work your way all through the end. It's really designed where you can pick and choose what's most useful and can be applied most directly to your quality improvement activities. There are different audiences for each of the tools, so some are developed for quality improvement staff, some for the management of the hospital, financial officers, et cetera. And on each tool, we indicate how it's intended to be used and who the audience is, as you'll see as we present the tools in a little bit more detail later on. The quality indicators that the toolkit targets are two sets of the RQIs. It's the inpatient quality indicators. Those cover volume, mortality for different conditions and procedures, as well as utilization rates. But we found that most hospitals are interested in using it for the PSIs, or patient safety indicators. There are currently 17 of those indicators plus a composite, and I imagine you all are familiar with those now as they are part of the LeapFrog safety score. Some of them are. We've been through, we're now on our second version of this toolkit. The first toolkit was released in 2011. And we went through a development process there that started with an alpha version of the toolkit. There was a heavy portion of this that was involved field testing and evaluation of that alpha version. So for that, we recruited hospitals to use this in real quality improvement activities. We observed how they used it, and we got feedback from them on what was useful, what could be changed. And the results of that were used to then revise the toolkit. And that version was published in 2011. As Jen mentioned, we then just recently released the update. And there are two main changes to that. The first is that we added a large number of best practice forms. So these are best practices, evidence-based best practices associated with the different indicators. The first version had that for selected indicators, and here we really increased the number of indicators for which those are available. And Courtney will show you what one of those looks like. We also brought all the tools up to date for any changes that have occurred between 2011 and 2014. The steps that we took to develop the toolkit are as follows. First of all, we established some guiding principles to provide a cohesive framework for the toolkit. We reviewed literature to ensure that it was evidence-based. We developed the outline of the toolkit so that it covered all the steps of a complete quality improvement process, and then we identified and developed specific tools that matched each of those steps. All of this work was guided by a technical advisory panel. They brought various skills and perspectives to the table, including hospital experience, quality improvement experience, and research skills that helped us in interpret the evidence and putting together the toolkit. And as I mentioned, they've been involved throughout this process and continue to be engaged with our work today. The principles that guided the toolkit development are as follows. First of all, parsimony in tool choice and design. So we want to keep this as simple as possible to make it as usable as possible. We want to target the most important factors for implementation. We want to, and also things that offer the most value for hospitals and for a range of hospitals. We want the content to be readily accessible. And then we also wanted to focus on enabling hospitals to assess the effectiveness of all their actions. So can they assess what's working and what's not working? As I mentioned, the field test was an important part of the development of this. And the feedback we received when we did that field test was very helpful. First of all, we did find that the hospitals involved found it to be usable and useful, so that was a relief. And then we also found that hospitals varied widely in how they used it, how exactly they used it. So it was useful to a wide range of different hospitals, and they all had a different way of engaging with the toolkit. They chose different tools or used them in different ways, which is as we designed it to be. One of the areas that was flagged as being most useful for hospitals was in helping to achieve consensus. They found that sometimes it was useful to have a resource that was developed by a third party to come in areas where consensus building was needed. So that's areas like, to what extent are there gaps in quality, and what are the appropriate evidence-based best practices to apply to address those gaps. We also learned three other key things that we used to then revise the toolkit. The first thing was, a theme was that hospitals need to trust their data. So what was described to us in every hospital was that there is a somewhat lengthy process that hospitals go through in understanding what the indicators are showing them and identifying in their data where they're picking up real events, so real events that impact patient care versus things that might be just related to measurement. So these indicators are based on administrative data, and as such, they are based only as good as the documentation and coding under that data. And it's extremely important before hospitals jump into actual quality improvement that they understand the indicators. The second thing was that we found that priority setting is challenging. I think this is probably even more true today than it was when we did this a few years ago, this field test. We found that each hospital was under a number of different competing demands. So there's public reporting activities, paper performance. Within each hospital, you have their own priorities that are related to your patient population and what your needs are. And choosing the quality improvement targets was a real challenge in these kind of environments. And the third thing was the importance of keeping the tools short and simple. It can't be underscored enough. So we revised the toolkit, and the toolkit we have today, we attempt to address all those things. So the toolkit now includes a documentation and coding tool. That includes some tips that are designed to improve the validity of the indicators. We also have a prioritization matrix to help choose the quality improvement target, and we revise that to make it as flexible as possible so that each hospital can weight the factors that they consider most important in choosing between topics to address. And then finally, we simplified everything, including the instructions and the tools themselves, to increase their usability. So all of those changes have been implemented. That toolkit is now posted, and it's available in the link that Jan shared earlier. Looking forward to the future, we are in the process of developing a pediatric toolkit that will focus on the PDIs. We're following a similar development process to the one I just outlined, so there will be a field test and evaluation of that as well, and we're recruiting for that right now, in case anybody's interested in that. We have a release for that planned in spring of 2016. So we're going to be following a full year of a quality improvement field test, and then we'll revise and release after that. And with that, I'd like to hand over to my colleague, Courtney Gedengel.
Thank you so much, Peter. So I'd like to take a little time now to just tell you about how the ARC-QI toolkit is structured and what the component tools are like. So I'll start by telling you a little bit about the roadmap, which you can think of as a shopping list that a hospital could use to quickly identify which tools would be useful at any given time. And then the remainder of the toolkit has seven sections, A through G, which can be thought of as steps in the quality improvement process. Section A relates to assessing readiness to change. Once you're ready, then you can apply the QIs to your hospital data to see where you stand in relation to the QIs. Section C helps hospitals identify priorities for quality improvement so they know where to focus efforts. Section D offers information on implementation methods, so really supporting the project. Section E relates to monitoring progress and sustainability once improvements have been implemented. Section F shows hospitals how to perform a return on investment analysis. And finally, Section G offers links to existing quality improvement resources in case a hospital wants even more information than we provide in the toolkit. So the roadmap, as I mentioned, it's sort of like a shopping list or a navigational guide that can help a hospital figure out which tools to use and what exactly they are. And a hospital might choose to use only the tools that they find helpful given their current QI capabilities and efforts. So the roadmap itself is an ARC webpage on the website which lists the tools along with a link to each actual tool. And the tools themselves may be a PDF, a Word document, an Excel spreadsheet, or a PowerPoint presentation, depending on the tool. And then for each tool, the roadmap describes the action step that's being taken when you implement the tool, a brief description of the tool, and a title. And the roadmap also describes the key audience for that particular tool, as well as the position with lead role responsibility. So who would really take a lead role in using this tool? The first section of the toolkit is readiness to change, which is a really important first step. Is your hospital ready to make some changes? So tools A1A and A1B are about getting to know the indicators. They are fact sheets on the IQIs and the PSIs. So they introduce them and list them. The fact sheets provide 2011 national rates for the indicators, which are based on ARC's HCUP, which is the healthcare cost and utilization project data. And the fact sheets also indicate which of the indicators have been endorsed by the National Quality Forum, or NQF. Tool A2 is a really nice tool that provides a template for a presentation that could be made to hospital leadership and other staff on the quality indicators. So the goal is really to help board members and relevant staff understand why the ARC-QI QIs are so important. You know, what's the financial and clinical implications for your hospital? And what's nice is that the user can edit this PowerPoint presentation, and in the notes view of PowerPoint, you can see additional instructions for how to use this tool. So this is just a sample slide from the presentation template that we provide. As you can see, it has some information about why leadership is key to improvement, and it can be edited to be customized as needed. So what's really nice about this tool and this presentation is that it is customizable, but it also does a lot of the legwork for quality leaders who really want to motivate their hospital's leadership to engage in the quality improvement process. So rather than having to start from scratch and create a presentation, it has a lot of built-in text that you can take advantage of if you so choose. Tool A3 is a checklist that helps you figure out if you are ready for change. So it's a self-assessment. And it queries in two main domains. One is whether the infrastructure is there for change management, and then just readiness to work on the ARC-QIs. And the goal is really for leadership, you know, senior executives like the CMO, the chief quality officer, nursing leadership, maybe mid-level management, and members of the hospital quality committee should all independently review this tool and do the ratings and comments and then meet to discuss it and really reconcile where they're all coming from to make sure that everyone's on the same page as far as, setting the stage for identifying priorities and deciding what resources to commit. This slide just shows a snippet of the self-assessment itself. So as you can see, it asks the users to rate a series of statements. So we have a shared sense of purpose that quality and safety are our highest priorities. And then leaves space for additional comments so that people can come together and discuss how they feel about these statements and make sure that the requirements are in place. The next set of tools are the B tools, which are available to help hospitals apply the QAs to their own data. Tool B1 is really just an introduction to applying the indicators to the data and gives an overview of what the data requirements are and the issues that you might come across in using data in this way. It also explains all the different rates that you can calculate for the QIs and how to work with them. It gives an example of how to interpret a hospital's QI rates and then gives guidance for how you should assess performance using things like trends and benchmarking, which I'll explain in more detail shortly. Tools B2A and B2B are documents that explain the software that ARC provides on its website for calculating IQI and PSI rates. So ARC offers both a SaaS program and Windows QI software, and we have a tool for each type of software so that users have a choice as to which one they feel more comfortable with or have the resources to use. So both of the tools for these software, regardless of which software is used, give an outline of the steps in the programs that need to be done to calculate the rates for the indicators. There are some really useful notes for analysts and programmers with tips on issues that might come up and how to manage them when you're working with the SaaS programs and the Windows software that are sort of lessons learned from people that have been through this. And finally, the tool ends with some examples of actual output from each of the software programs for a hospital and how to interpret it. So it tells you what to do and then also shows what kind of results you're going to get so you can really understand it when you do it yourself. The next tools, tools B3A and B3B, are meant to be used in tandem, really, to allow you to generate graphical displays of your hospital's QI rates. So the idea is that you would use the Excel worksheet, put in your own data, and come up with graphical displays of the rates. And then it links to a really nice PowerPoint presentation that allows you to just take the data and the results and very easily present it to hospital stakeholders who would be making decisions about what to do next. This next slide is just an example of one of the many graphs that could be produced by the Excel spreadsheet, and this is what the PowerPoint slide would look like. It shows the risk-adjusted rate along with the lower and upper confidence intervals, and the risk-adjusted rate is just an estimate of how a hospital would perform on an indicator for an average case mix of patients rather than for its own case mix, which is really useful if you're trying to compare your performance over time, and let's say you think your hospital's case mix may have changed, or if you're trying to compare yourself to other hospitals in the area or that are like yours but might have a slightly different case mix. And then underneath the risk-adjusted rates, we have a benchmark rate, which you could generate either from national data or if you were part of a system or consortium where you had access to others' data, you could set that as a benchmark. Tool B4 is about documentation and coding tips for the PSIs, and it was really developed directly in response to a need that came up during the field test of the toolkit. So the goal is to help hospitals improve their documentation and coding processes to ensure that PSI rates are accurate. You know, it's obviously really important before putting resources into a problem to make sure that it's truly a quality problem and not simply a problem of coding and documentation that could be changed without actually needing to do quality improvement. So this tool has two sections. The first one just describes procedures to address problems with documentation and coding. And then the second section identifies common coding and documentation issues that come up, and they're organized by PSI. So if you, let's say, want to focus on iatrogenic pneumothorax and you think you have some kind of coding problem, you can just go right to that section of the table. And all of these tips were gathered from UHC's coding experts and feedback from users in our field test. The last B tool, which is tool B5, supports the development of trend and benchmark information. So this really allows hospitals to compare themselves either to themselves or to other hospitals on QI rates. So hospitals might want to compare their current performance to performance in previous years, which would be looking at trends. Or, as I mentioned before, they may want to compare themselves to similar hospitals or to national rates, which would be comparing based on benchmarks. And what's nice is once that's decided how you're going to do the comparison, it really sets the stage for prioritizing QIs once you have the data available to look at and can understand it. So that brings us to our next section, which is section C. After assessing readiness for change and then applying the QIs to your hospital's data and feeling comfortable that the data is coded correctly, the final step before actually implementing change is to really figure out what the priorities are for quality improvement at your own hospital. So what we created were these two C tools. C1 is a prioritization matrix, and then C2 is a completed prioritization matrix. So you can see the kind of numbers that would go into that. The matrix lists each of the indicators as its own row, so you can choose to focus on some or all of them. They're organized by different categories to make it easier as well. And then the columns are coded by colors to represent various important aspects of prioritization. The blue columns are filled out with your own rate and a national benchmark rate or other benchmark rate. The green section relates to costs, so it asks you to estimate the annual cost of the event of interest and then the cost of implementing an improvement to get a sense of where the issues may be there. The purple section relates to how strategically aligned the indicator is with your hospital's priorities. And then the orange section is a barrier assessment to try and anticipate what difficulties might come up as you try to improve in these indicators. So the idea is that once the matrix is completed, it'll give you information that can help guide your decision about which indicators should be invested in. So the next section is on implementation methods, and this assumes that you know that your hospital is ready to change, that you understand your data and can apply the QIs to your data, and that you've identified priorities for improvement. So these tools are designed to help your hospital actually implement the changes to improve performance on indicators. Tool D1 is just a big overview of improvement methods and gives a framework that you could use to evaluate current systems and promote new systems. Tool D2 is a really nice sort of project team management tool. It's a project charter template that you can use to kick off the improvement process. So the idea is that the improvement team would get together and complete this project charter template, and then once it's done, it would describe the performance improvement rationale, your team's goals, the barriers you think could come up, and the anticipated resources to which the team will commit. Just to note, we don't have a D3 tool. The next indicator is D4. That's because when we expanded the toolkit and expanded D4, we realized that D3 had become duplicative and possibly confusing. So we removed it because we were able to expand D4. But we did retain the original numbering of the tools to make it easier to provide continuity between the toolkits. So this D4 tool is actually a set of subtools, and it was really useful to users in our field test. So this tool contains best practices and suggestions for improvements, and it's really a set of evidence-based best practices for each indicator as appropriate. We have best practices for most but not all of the indicators because some of them either really had no evidence base to use, and some of them are just not amenable to a best practices form. Tool D4 is an overall introduction to the best practices tool and explains what it is. And then tools D4A through D4N outline the best practices for each of 14 PSIs. And then there's a more general mortality review that relates to all of the mortality-based IQIs, so we don't have best practices for the individual IQIs. We have best practices for almost all of the PSIs, as I mentioned, including most of those that are used in the LeapFrog safety score. Some of those that are not included in the LeapFrog safety score, such as pressure ulcer, still seems to be captured in the safety score and could still be of interest. It's just not used as an RQI per se. So we cover pressure ulcers, retained surgical items, iatrogenic pneumothorax, which is in the LeapFrog safety score, and I've bolded here, central venous catheter-related bloodstream infections, postoperative hip fractures, perioperative hemorrhage or hematomas, and postoperative physiologic and metabolic derangement rates. And then we have postoperative respiratory failure rate, part of the safety score, as is perioperative pulmonary embolism or DVT, postoperative sepsis, postoperative wound dehiscence, and accidental puncture or laceration. And then the final two PSIs are obstetric ones, which we combined into a single best practices form because a lot of the best practices overlapped. So that's obstetric trauma rate, which is vaginal delivery with and without an instrument. Of note, we do not have a best practices for PSI 4, which is the final component, final RQI that's used in the LeapFrog safety score. That's because for death rate among surgical inpatients with serious treatable conditions, we already covered some of those conditions like DVT, pulmonary embolism, and sepsis in some of the existing best practices. And then the remaining conditions were just too heterogeneous to really feasibly capture in one best practices form. So I just wanted to give you a sense of the structure of the best practices form. They start with a really nice section called Why Focus On, which gives a sense of why the problem is important and is, you know, will hopefully engage leadership and others in this process with that specific indicator. There's a high-level summary of the best practices, and then we describe the recommended practices in more detail, ending with the staff required, the equipment that you might need, the communication that would need to be in place, and then, importantly, authority and accountability so that you can assign that as you're working on the indicator. And then each form ends with additional references just in case users would like to go more in-depth and look at the sources themselves. So here I just wanted to show you what the form itself looks like. The first part is a little snippet from the iatrogenic pneumothorax form, and it asks why should we focus on this problem. And so you can see we give some information about the importance of pneumothorax, how it might increase costs and length of stay, which is a lot of interest to some hospitals. It also highlights that it's both a non-reimbursable complication and that it's going to be part of Medicare's hospital value-based purchasing in 2015. And then the second snippet on the slide just shows the summary table of all of the best practices. So just at a glance from the first page, you get a sense of why this is important and then, you know, at a very high level, what the recommended practices are. The next two D-tools are a gap analysis, which helps the hospital understand the extent to which current practices align with best practices. And then finally, another nice project management tool, which is the implementation plan. So this allows the team to get together and just very clearly assign responsibilities for the improvement project and set a timeline. And then the last two D-tools, D7 relates to implementation measurement, so that the teams can really understand what impact their work is having and measure progress as they go along in improving work and clinical care processes. And tool D8 is meant to be used as the project comes to a close, and it's an evaluation and debriefing to really understand what worked in the implementation process for the team and that what needs improvement the next time this issue was addressed or maybe when they next tackle a quality improvement issue. The E section is really just one tool. This tool is meant to be used really once the improvement effort has come to a close in terms of the active phase, and it's meant to be able to provide support for sustainability of improvement. So it gives information on what would be involved in ongoing monitoring, how would you establish a schedule for regular reporting, supports the development of report formats so you can communicate clearly about what is going on as time passes. It helps establish procedures to act on problems as they come up, and then give some information on how you can assess sustainability on a periodic basis. Tool F is another standalone tool. It's a return on investment analysis, also meant to be done once the investment is over. So it's really a step-by-step guide to calculating return on investment, which is really useful if you've never actually done this before, but can also be used by people that are comfortable with this process. So there are some worksheets that help calculate net costs and returns. There's a case study for return on investment calculation. And then there are some additional guidance and tips for how you can most effectively do this calculation. And then finally, for those who would like to go more in depth, there are resources and information sources. The last set of tools, the G tools, are additional existing quality improvement resources that aside from the toolkit that might be useful to users. So tool G1 is provides sort of more general, overall, comprehensive quality improvement guides, whereas tool G2 are really specific tools to support change around particular analytic processes or action tools if there's a particular part of the QI process that a hospital is struggling with. And then Tool G3 is a case study of PSI improvement implementation at a hospital. So in summary, the ARC-QI toolkit is available to support hospitals that want to improve performance. The toolkit is really comprehensive, and it addresses all of the stages of improvement, starting from self-assessment for readiness to change to ongoing monitoring once an improvement effort has finished. The tools themselves are designed to be really practical, accessible, easy to use, and designed to meet a variety of needs, you know, from hospitals that maybe have not done a lot of quality improvement to those that are more experienced. And you can find the QI toolkit at this link that you see on your screen. So I'd like to thank you for your attention. We'd like to open up the floor for any clarifying questions that you might have about the toolkit's contents or structure or development process. Before we move on to Ellen Robinson and her sharing of her hospital's experience. So if the operator could come on the line and give us instructions for questions.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question today, please press star 1 on your touch-tone telephone. A voice prompt on your phone line will indicate when your line has been open. Once again, that's star 1. If you have a question, we'll pause for just a moment. Again, that's star 1 for questions. We do have a question. Your line is open. Caller, your line is open. Please check your mute function. Once again, if you heard the voice prompt, your line is now open. You can ask your question. Hearing no response, we'll go to the next caller.
Hi. Richard? This is Richard. How do I get access to the ARC measures downloaded into the various spreadsheets? Is there a tool to get that?
So there's a tool. What ARC provides is software to be used with your hospital's data to calculate the rates. And in the toolkit, there's a section that kind of walks you through that whole process, so how to prepare your data and run it through the ARC software to do it. It's available for SaaS and Windows, so it does require that there's somebody on the end who has some programming experience designed for that, but our tool is designed to make that process as easy as possible.
So that's the first step?
That's the first step in being able to measure. That's one of the early steps, yep.
Thank you.
And again, ladies and gentlemen, it's star 1 if you have a question at this time. And we'll go to the next question. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm on the website now, and I can see all of the toolkit. Is there a way to download everything, maybe in a zip file or all at one time, or do you have to download individually?
Yep, there's a compressed version archive. If you go to the main website for the ARC-QI Indicators Toolkit for Hospitals, in the top right-hand corner under alternate formats, it's called Compressed Version Archive, and that pulls out the entire toolkit. And then if you wanted to, you could, the other option is to go to the roadmap and just individually download every tool. But if you wanted to do it all at the same time, you would do it with that zip file.
And actually, this is Jan. We are in the process of the compressed file that you see there on that page is still in the process of being updated to this latest version. The roadmap is current, but we can let you all know when that compressed file has been updated as well.
Thank you very much.
And we'll go to the next question. Rita, your line is open. Please go ahead.
Thank you. My question was answered.
Thank you. We'll go to the next question.
Is there a cost associated with the software?
No.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Next caller, your line is open.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Tony Wormuth from Cleveland Clinic. Question about the spreadsheet that you showed where you can evaluate the costs and the impact of your interventions. Do you have any evidence-based cost data already available and compiled at the PSI or QI level, IQI level that people can use, or do most hospitals just kind of come up with that on their own through their own literature review?
The short answer is it's best for the hospitals to do that on their own. That was one of the central issues we looked at, and there just isn't a valid source of that cost information available out there. So it is designed to be used with each hospital's own data.
And then just a quick follow-up on that. I know there's been several iterations of the ARC versions 4.5 and 4.5A. So the tool gets updated as in those SAS and the Windows-based tool. Those are those all updated through 4.5A? And then when it goes to ICD-10, will there be like a 5.0 available, or is that available now that we could start running some of our numbers in these PSIs and IQIs using the ICD-10 codes?
Yeah, so those are great questions. We just updated the toolkit, and I'm not remembering off the top of my head whether it was 4.5 or 4.5A, but it does indicate in the tool what version of the QIs it was updated through. Of course, ARC is continually updating the indicators. Most of the tools will not change very much. So you could still really use the tool. You need the latest version of the ARC software, which is separately available, but then the tool will do something like take the output of that, and the output doesn't generally change very much between versions. We just confirmed it is actually version 4.5 that the most recent update covers. The ICD-10 issue is a big one, and that is something where we're looking at our options for the best way to update the toolkit itself. And I know that ARC is also working on an update of the QIs, the indicators themselves in the software, to use with ICD-10, but I believe that's not ready yet. And it may be that somebody from ARC would like to weigh in with a little bit more information there, but I think the bottom line on the ICD-10 is that they're working on that version, but it's not yet complete.
Yeah, this is Joanna Jane from ARC. The QI team here has been working on the converting the QI from ICD-9 to ICD-10. So we definitely want to make sure that the QI measure will be ICD-10 version to match the timeline next year. And then the toolkits will be updated later, probably. But hopefully, we're still working on the schedule to make sure that the toolkits will still be applicable after the ICD-10 version go into effect.
We'll go to our next question. Caller, your line is open.
Hello, this is Deborah Hendrickson from Eden Medical Center. I'm wondering, well, first of all, thank you for this. I think this will be very helpful and will certainly answer some of the questions that we've had here locally. But I'm wondering if there are other quality metrics in the pipeline, and if so, what those might be, and if you will be updating the toolkit as those become effective.
Yes, so in one moment I'll hand it to ARC to comment on the question about the quality metrics, because they are the ones who develop the QIs. As far as the toolkit, we don't have plans right now to develop additional versions for other indicators except for the pediatric quality indicators, the PDIs, which I mentioned. That said, the toolkit was designed, although it focuses on the QIs, most of the tools are also very applicable to any other quality indicator. So in the field test of the indicator, for example, some of the hospitals used, for example, alternative measures that they were tracking for central line infections. And most of the tools worked very well. Of course, the tools that were designed for use in the ARC software were not applicable, but things like the prioritization matrix, all the other tools that Courtney showed you would be applicable as well. And Joanna or somebody from ARC, would you like to comment on the question about the metric development?
Thanks, Peter. This is Jan. We don't currently have new indicators in the pipeline. You can check back periodically on the quality indicators webpage, which is different than the toolkit page. You can actually just put in ARC quality indicators and Google that, and it will come right up, and you will see the current modules that are included.
We'll go to our next question. Caller, your line is open.
Yes, this is Luana Dyer calling from Arlington. I was wondering if there was a separate section for the best practices on the website.
The best practices on the website, if you go to the roadmap link and go to section D4, you'll see that each best practice is listed by name. There's both a PDF and a Word version, so you can download all of them individually or just select the ones that you are interested in.
Great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Next caller, your line is open. Once again, from Lake Medical Center, your line is open.
Yes, I had a question about the makeup of the team. I see here the case study on Cedars-Sinai. And, of course, you want your executive sponsor, your physician, project manager, your data guru. What, I guess at Cedars-Sinai or other hospitals that have implemented this, who did they pick for their team members?
That's a good question. I'm going to have to think back to the field test. And this might be something that would be great to have Ellen comment on how she did it, Ellen Robinson, and how they did this at Harborview. It differed depending on the hospital and what indicator they focused on. But it was essentially, I think you basically named the categories of people that they looked to fill. So there was a quality improvement liaison. So in some cases, that was somebody who was a director of a quality improvement department. In some cases, a hospital would choose somebody who was associated with one of the clinical departments. So, for example, in one hospital, they were focusing on the obstetric indicators. And so they had somebody who was a physician quality leader from the obstetrics department leading that. And in some cases, they would have a separate executive liaison to the group. And in some cases, they did not. It was the same person. Again, really depending on the makeup of that hospital. And then in some hospitals, they did have a data guru or a programmer that would be on. In some cases, they didn't. So some hospitals, they had access to the indicator data from somewhere else. They didn't even actually run it at their hospitals. A lot of these hospitals would get it from UHC, and so they didn't have that role. And maybe, Ellen, if you'd like to comment on that either now or during your presentation, I'm sure it'd be of interest.
Yeah, I have it in my presentation by specific indicator, so I'm happy to highlight that when we go through.
Great, thank you.
And actually, this is Jan. I think we're going to move along here because we're almost to 3 o'clock. So thank you, Peter and Courtney, and thanks for all of you who've asked questions. We're going to go ahead and move to Ellen for her presentation now.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining. As I mentioned, I'm out in Seattle, so it's still morning here, not quite, almost to noon, and I want to share with you our experience utilizing the toolkit. So what I'm hoping to discuss today is, you know, how we're using this data to measure quality at a very high enterprise level. I'd like to give you some examples of various parts of the toolkit and how we utilized it to operationalize our PSI review. And then lastly, I want to share with you some of the opportunities that we found by using the PSI information to improve the care our patients receive. So who are we? This is us. We are out in Seattle. We are Level 1 Trauma Center, and we cover more than 25% of the land mass of the United States, and that's because we have Alaska. So our patients come from all over the Pacific Northwest. On the left, you can see also our mission. So we are a county hospital with a safety net population. We're 400 beds with 90 ICU beds, and we do about 20,000 admissions a year, just to give you a sense of the size. We also provide about 18% of the charity care that goes on in the state of Washington. So we have quite a diverse mission statement and diverse population. So this is me when I started on this journey, this process. I essentially was given the assignment from my brand new boss when I joined QI to figure out these PSIs and, you know, decide what we're supposed to do with them. And as I worked through this journey in 2009, I really wished I had had a toolkit to use. We were lucky enough to be one of the sites that tested the toolkit in the collaboration between the University Hospital Consortium and RAND and AHRQ. And so I was able to then integrate some of these tools into my already ongoing work. And really since 2011, we've been really utilizing this data very strongly on a regular basis. And so currently, in the last few years, we've actually integrated a PSI measure as a marker of patient safety across our UW Medicine enterprise. So this includes ourselves and the University of Washington Medical Center, as well as our two community hospital partners. These scores are reviewed on a monthly basis at both our board level and at many other leadership meetings across the organization. So it's become a really integral part of our patient safety measure. When we began this process, we really had two goals. We wanted to be able to understand what was being externally reported, and at that time, we were really getting our external information from the University Health System Consortium. They provide you with a scorecard, and the PSI data is used in their safety domain. Our second goal was really to be able to standardize some internal case identification for team review. So we have a very robust committee that's called the Medical QI Committee, and there's a representative from each service and department across the hospital. And they do all their morbidity and mortality reviews. They bring them up through their own personal departments, and then they share them out monthly at this peer physician-led meeting. And what we found at that time was that some people really reviewed a lot of cases, and other groups didn't review hardly any cases. And so we decided we would use the PSI to identify the possibly preventable harm events and send them forward for clinical review. By standardizing and centralizing this process, we also knew we'd be able to track the outcomes of the reviews and try to trend them over time for some possible opportunities. So I'm going to just kind of go through some of the sections that Courtney's already discussed and just share out how we use them. So if you're starting fresh off scratch and you don't know anything about PSIs, the fact sheets are really, really helpful. They give you some talking points to get around when you're starting to share out with other teams. People on your team. The specification guidelines are important so you know who's included, who's excluded, and kind of what is the purpose of these various PSIs. So we utilized the readiness to change document and did a self-assessment. We were lucky that our medical director at the hospital had been our previous director of quality improvement. So he was really spearheading this project. We had good leadership support, and he had direction of how he wanted us to take it. He had already kind of warmed up our board, and so our board was on board with this project, and they said, yeah, you know, we're going to look at this, and we're going to say this is a good measure of safety in our hospital. Some of the challenges we identified was that we really had not been doing a very good job at getting the quality and patient safety information down to our front lines. So our C-suite and our boards knew about it, but if you'd asked the front line staff what's a PSI or what's a safety indicator, they really wouldn't have had a good sense of that. When you get to the point about applying the indicators to your own hospital data, and I think this question came up earlier, you can download the free software to be able to run it yourself. And prior to us using the software, we used the UHC's database to track our rates and to track our rankings. Well, the UHC quarterly summaries are about 3 months behind, and if for us anyway, if I waited to use that database to get my cases to review, I'd be 6 to 8 weeks behind. And we really felt like that was too late to make an impact. To send someone a case about something that happened, you know, back in July, the residents aren't here anymore, nobody remembers what really happened. And so we really wanted to figure out how do we get our data in, quote, real time. Most of it's, all of it's based on billing data, so the person at least has to be discharged. And we really wondered, can we get our own internal data through the software and use it and get the same results? So we utilize 3M as our billing system, and so every hospital will need to figure out, you know, what's your internal source system that I can use to input the data. 3M comes out in a format that is not doesn't fit with the specifications of the software. So we utilize a Perl script, which is a programming language, to transform what we get out of 3M into a file that we can run through the software. So again, it is free and really easy to download, but your source system being able to map through the software can be difficult. It did take us, I'd say, 2 to 3 months of trial and error to get a match with what we have on UHC. So one of the things, if you're starting the project, would be to really tag out someone in IT to be your point person. We are lucky enough to have 3 programmers within our quality improvement department, so him and I were able to work very closely to kind of get it up and running. And then once you can run it, you can run it by the month, you can run it by the quarter, you can run a whole year worth of data, and the reports that you can get out of the software are very easy to get. They're easy to use. And so you can get the numerator and denominators of the various publicly reported values. And again, what we really utilized were the numerators to help us track the events that happened for possible opportunities to improve care. One thing that the previous question was mentioned about the versioning is to make sure that if you are comparing against publicly reported data, that you know which version they are using, because if you're using a different version, your denominators might be slightly off, and so it's really important to kind of keep up to date with those changes and understand who's using what. We use the Windows version, just for FYI. So we were then going to figure out how are we going to identify which things we're going to work on. And so, again, this is a screenshot from back at that time that we get from UHC that shows a lot of red dots, and nobody likes a red dot. So we really had a lot of opportunities. And so how do you prioritize which thing you're going to start with? And so that's where we found this spreadsheet to be really, really useful. As someone mentioned, we did come up with some costs, some based on our own internal sources, some based on some of the work that UHC kind of provided us with. And we just filled out this grid, and we filled out what was our rate, what was the target from the software, what was the average of UHC, and how were we falling down or performing well when compared against that. And I think another very important part is to figure out the purple section where, you know, are people willing to work on this? Is it within the goals? What's the public perception of these? And then that barrier assessment. And so when we filled this out, we found the 3 were going to be the ones we started to work on: pressure ulcers, central line infections, and postoperative DVT. And since that point, we've expanded to focus on respiratory failure, sepsis, and accidental puncture. So next we decided we needed to take it on the road, and this is where I had already done a lot of these presentations, but those PowerPoints that were mentioned as one of the A tools will be a perfect tool to take to use. I presented at MedExec Board, Critical Care, the Hospital Board, worked with both coding, clinical documentation specialists, and essentially tried to summarize, you know, what is a PSI and why do we care about it? What's our current performance, and then how does that rank us when we look across at our peers through the UHC? And then what we really wanted to lay out to our clinical teams is we're going to come to an agreement. We're going to review them for you first, and what's the expectations we have from you? And so one of the things that our physicians were very concerned about was, well, hey, this stuff is based on billing data, and everybody knows that isn't right. And so we said, you know what, we will do the billing piece. We will work on those, and I will only send you a case that has been proven to be a real event. But what I need from you is to review it in a standardized way and get it back to me quickly. And so we were able to kind of join that partnership. The projects that we worked on through the documentation and coding group, as I'll outline in a little bit, are slightly different, but kind of that same, setting those expectations early. It was mentioned I'm a physical therapist. I'm not a project manager. So when I came on to this project, I would have loved to have some of these tools, and I have utilized these tools now for many other projects, as Peter mentioned. Being able to have a standardized charter, figure out a gap analysis and an implementation plan is just useful on any project that you're about to start. And I just wanted to highlight that for anyone starting a new project, these would be great, and they may even be useful if you're a person who's going to be a point person, maybe is a nurse who's doing a project, or a resident who's doing a project. These are also tools that they can use to run their reviews. So here are kind of how we form these teams. So we knew that, you know, the same people who are going to look at pressure ulcers are not the people who are going to look at sepsis. So who are your experts in this area? And then we formed these different task force. And so to go through some of them again, we already had people working on pressure ulcers that were clinical nurse specialists, PTs and OTs. They reviewed all hospital-acquired pressure ulcers. So we just said, hey, let's loop that into that already existing group. We know infection control at every hospital is already looking at CLABSI. So how do you compare your CLABSI rates to your PSIs and ensure those things line up? One of the larger groups I'm going to highlight is our anticoagulation task force. And in this case, we had two physicians, a trauma surgeon as well as a hospitalist. We included pharmacists, nursing, and QI support on these reviews. For respiratory failure, we have a spine surgeon as our point person with also anesthesia, respiratory involved, and respiratory therapy involvement. Again, we already have a sepsis team, so we just leverage that group who's a physician, a nurse, and a patient safety officer to loop them in. And then for the accidental punctures, we utilize our surgeons for help and our clinical documentation specialists and coding to help the surgeons understand what the measure meant and what they needed to write. So kind of a variety across the board of the various partners that we made with these groups. Again, was highlighted earlier about these coding and documentation improvements. So as you're starting forward, you really have to dig in to understand the definitions. You want to think about the inclusion and exclusion and how that may impact your specific population. So an example would be, you know, one of the first pressure ulcers I reviewed, I said, well, this patient, you know, is a C5 complete quadriplegic. I wonder why he's not excluded. Well, in talking with our coders, they said, well, quadriplegia is a symptom, and so, you know, we don't always code it because, you know, you get the complete cervical spinal cord injury in this other code, but it's the quadriplegia that would exclude them from having a preventable pressure ulcer. So those were things that really the documentation and coding people really helped us understand, and I think you need to look at your own population. You may have people where, based on the coding, it's not really an event, but the coding kind of flags it because, again, these are possible opportunities. They're not saying for sure they're opportunities. They're trying to help you find things. You also may find that your present on admission indicators may be unclear. So the physicians know the patient arrived with this, but they didn't write it down that way, and so it's coded more as hospital acquired instead of present on admission. So where are we now? So currently, I run our input file out of our billing system through the software about 10 days after the end of the previous month, and that helps me flag all of the cases. We utilize just an access database, an internal one, to help us track what we do with each of those cases and what our physicians tell us about the case after they review. And then again, as I mentioned, our providers report these cases findings up through our MQIC committee, which happens on a monthly basis. This is just a schematic of the process. So we get the cases each month, run it through the software, and then this is kind of where I do my analysis. And just for volume, we probably have about 30 cases a month for myself to review. Sometimes it's just what I call a flawed metric. You know, it's not really coding. There wasn't really an event. It's just the way that the software flagged it, and we just write those off. If I find it was a real event, it goes out to the services, and they review it in a standardized way, and they might have a quality concern or they might not have a quality concern. It may just be patient disease. For those where I think it's more of a documentation and a coding problem, we review those together. And again, if we agree, it's either maybe the wrong code was placed, so maybe the patient really had a lower extremity DVT and it was coded as an upper, or maybe there's an exclusion code missing, those then get updated by coding. This is just a screenshot of our numerator tracking. So when we send out the cases to our teams, we give them a quick overview of the clinical situation, the event that the case occurred. Because if you have a patient who's here for 3 months and you say, tell me about this event, that takes a lot of time for your physicians. So we try to pin down the event. We ask them the specific details that we want them to review, and then we track their response. And we've been putting these events into buckets, either that there was some possible preventable harm, that the event was unavoidable, it was based on documentation, or it was a flawed metric. And that allows us to kind of look over time as to what our situations are around each of these PSIs. So we have a web-based tool for our quality reporting, and again, we look at just these rates of PSI events. And the way we've rolled it up is just we take all the numerators and all the eligible denominators, and we throw them in and make a rate. So it's a very crude measure, but we found it was easy to explain, and it's been able to be recreated across the four hospitals. So this is just over the last fiscal year, you know, the number of events divided by the number of eligible cases in time, and then this is just through the first quarter of events. And so this is, again, reviewed on an ongoing basis at multiple forums, and it has really raised the question, you know, so you have these events. If you have a high rate of events, does that mean you have a quality issue? And are all of these PSIs really, quote, preventable, or are they potentially related to the severity of illness of the patients? And that's really what we've tried to get into. So to give an example, we had a very high rate of DVTs. And actually, if I go back, you can see here, this is our post-op DVTs, the raw numbers and the rates. And when you add up all the other events, we have the most post-op DVTs across all of the things. So we knew that was going to be one of our focuses. And so we have a group that sits down and we review every event each month and we ask ourselves the question, was the standard of care met in terms of prophylaxis? So in compliance with our UW Medicine guidelines, was the right prophylaxis used? Was it started early enough? Did the patient get the right dosing of their chemical prophylaxis? And if they couldn't use chemical prophylaxis, did we use mechanical? And this team sits in a room together, and we spend about 5 minutes on each case. We have an electronic tool that gets us all the data. And we say, yep, that was nothing we could do about that one, versus, oh, you know, that person had their dose held for surgery, and I don't think they really should have had that done. Or potentially, oh, they didn't chart SCDs. Let's go find out, do we have enough SCD machines on each unit? And so it's really raised over time. These are the high-level areas that we've been able to hold. We've changed some of the scheduling of our prophylaxis dosing, as well as come to some agreements about what's a procedure you hold for and what's a procedure you don't hold for. And then if we find the opportunities, we do send these out. And, again, this is out on that same dashboard where we could say, okay, well, surgery, and some of these are still pending final review. You know, you had this many in the month. This is all, I guess, all of last fiscal year. So of your 41 DVTs, 35 met all the guidelines. And maybe six we might have had an opportunity. And we're pretty rigorous. You know, one missed dose early on, that gets sent out if it was missed for an OR, if it was held or missed during a transition of care. So we hold ourselves, we think, to a pretty high standard of what is meeting the guidelines. In terms of the return on investment, and I had to check in with our UW Medicine Finance person, and actually the way they've been using this is to try to figure out how you can measure the impact of reducing your patient safety indicators. So our finance department does an annual process review, and they wanted to stress that it was very, very simple. They essentially just compare last year's raw count of numbers times a certain dollar that we've assigned to each event, and if it's gone down, we call that a cost savings. And they're really trying to use this to measure the impact of the safety projects across those four medical centers. And she mentioned that this is reviewed once a year, and it's greatly valued by the executive team, and they really dig into the details of the numbers and the events that have been reduced. In terms of the existing QI resources that are out there on the toolkit, we tried to leverage those by linking a lot of them out to our web page. And I left the website here. It's through the University of Washington's Health Sciences Library. So we've linked a variety of those tools as well as measures for the things from the NQF, TJC, some examples of different publishing requirements and EndNote. And so just feel free to go out and take a look in case you want to try to leverage some of those links out to your own internal libraries. So my lessons learned, validate, validate, validate. There's nothing worse than going into a room and sharing with a surgeon that they have an iatrogenic pneumothorax and they say, yeah, they came in with it from the field. So, you know, understand your cases and be able to speak to them. Make sure you have a good leadership backing for your project. And I think, again, outlining what we expect back from our providers and holding them accountable for those reviews, because that's the only way we're going to get the information about what really occurred at the time of the event. Focus your presentations to your clinical providers on real clinical events. Don't get bogged down in the billing and the coding with that group. Really share with them, here's an example of what happened, and here's how it impacted the patient. I would recommend trying to get a coding or a project lead, a coding liaison or lead involved through their project so you can deal with one person to review these measures so they understand what you're looking at. And then again, customize your clinical task forces to address specific PSI categories, and then come up with a standard that you're going to say is preventable or not. Whatever two, three simple questions that as you review these events and say, yeah, you know, I know with our iatrogenic pneumothorax we say, you know, was ultrasound guide used? It? Yes. Was there a second operator there? Yes. Was the attending present? Yes. And that helps us kind of structure those reviews out to our clinical providers so we're all measuring kind of by the same measuring stick. And I just would like to thank my members of my team, all of our physician leaders, medical director, my QI, IT programming, and my boss, Patty. And this is just an example of our most recent scorecard with the UHC, which we're very proud of, as well as we're very happy to have received an A on the LeapFrog safety score this year. So I think that's all I have. I hope I didn't go too fast and wanted to leave some time for questions.
Ellen, thank you so much, and thank you also to Jan and Peter and Courtney. I'd like to ask the operator to come on at this point and open the line again for questions. The questions can be directed specifically to any of our four speakers or generally, and they'll decide amongst themselves who's best prepared to answer it. So we can open the line. Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, it is star one if you have a question at this time. Star one for questions. We'll pause for just a moment. We do have a question. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Sethu Vora from Hartford Healthcare. How are you?
Great. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Wonderful presentation. I really enjoyed it. I'm a pulmonary critical care physician and also director of performance improvement. And my question is, you know, a lot of effort needs to be made on educating the physician colleagues and the coding staff for the low-hanging fruits, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, then start looking at truly preventable PSI. There's so much variability in coding department that we deal with that they can pick up one area in the progress note and code out something as a post-op sepsis. And there's a high degree of opportunity there. We looked at post-op respiratory failure and found that any patient that was after a long spine case was kept intubated electively, the physicians were writing, you know, post-op respiratory failure, but that's what it is in their mind. But the true intent of the PSI was not really translated. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely came up with those kind of same issues, and so that's where we really used our clinical documentation specialists to ask those questions. With the respiratory failure, what we actually found was there was a checkbox for the attending to just check the box that the patient had respiratory failure at the bottom of the note.
Wow.
And so, you know, educating with them, making sure everybody used the same definitions. And again, sometimes that may be what they call it, though they don't think there was any problem with the care. And for those, we just say, okay, well, we don't think it's a problem. It got flagged. And, you know, we just kind of move on and try not to dwell too much on it and keep moving forward. But for those opportunities that you can make a change and make some decisions about how you're going to write things down, then
mm-hmm.
those are where you have the opportunity, I think.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
And we'll go to the next question.
Yes, I had two questions. One was related to the identification of the PSIs in real time. Could you really go over, Ellen, could you go over that again and how you actually identify them real time prior to the bill being dropped?
Sure. So I called it real time, but like I said, it does have to actually be after the bill's being dropped. So I run them, I'm about 10 days after the end of the month, and I run it once a month just because for me it works in my workflow. My partners over at the University of Washington actually run it twice a week, so they're finding cases, you know, potentially the day after the discharge. I think the only way to really try to get a sense of them in, quote, real time would be to leverage your clinical documentation specialist and have them, you know, if you were going to focus, let's say, on laceration and puncture, you know, have them be really reviewing every op note to see if, you know, if there was something that they might be able to help clarify. The problem I find with doing it too real time is that there are so many inclusions and exclusions that come through the secondary codes that you may create extra work for yourself if you're truly just looking for words that it may be a person who might not even be included in the denominator. So that's just something to be sensitive to.
Okay, great. That helps. And then you mentioned that you're pretty rigorous on whether or not you send something forward if a pharmacological dose for DVT, for example, is missed. Do you have then, have you developed, review tools, detailed review tools, so that you are reviewing each of the cases the same way so that you would identify the same thing for the same physician, for the same patient? To send forward for review for PPC?
Yeah, and I took a screenshot out for time's sake, and we can talk more offline after, but essentially what we do is we use our radiology and vascular systems to find all the positive events. So we look at all events, even if they're not a PSI 12, and then we have pulled into kind of a one-screen web-based tool anything that has to do with prophylaxis. So on one screen, we can quickly see the SCD charting, the chemical charting, the OR placement, and it just kind of runs in a timeline. We use Cerner, so we were finding it was taking a half an hour for every person to read one chart about the prophylaxis, and now we've kind of just pulled out of Cerner the few pieces that we care about, and then we can dig further into the documentation if needed.
All right, great. Thank you. That's all I had.
And we'll take the next question.
Hi, this is Amy Costello from Inland Hospital. This question was for Ellen. You mentioned that you use 3M and that it took quite a bit of mapping, but you were able to map it to the software. Did your IT people make a written process that you would be able to share?
Oh, he didn't. I don't believe he did. You know, this is one of those things you kind of don't realize that it's going to be with you for the next 6 years when you're doing it. But again, I know he uses a Perl script, which, you know, again, I guess is some kind of computer language. And I'm sure we could share that. Perl is a free program that you can download onto your machine. And so then once you get the output from 3M, I really just push this Perl button and it runs the script. So you can get my information. I'd be happy to share at least that part out with you. There's my email there.
Okay. Thank you very much.
We'll go to the next question. Rita, your line is open.
I'm trying to figure out how to do this.
Once again, Rita Espy, your line is now open. Please check your mute function.
There we go. Thank you. We were wondering, on the cases that are flagged, but you don't find that there's an actual issue, that you don't believe it's a real case, it's kind of a coding issue, you said that you really don't deal with that. But how, in this day of pay-for-performance measures, are you dealing with those? We're really concerned about those.
Yeah. So, you know, an example would be, for example, the wound dehiscence, right? So your wound dehiscence PSI is based on whether you reopen the exploratory laparotomy site. Well, we have trauma patients who come in whose abdomens are left open and have 5 washouts. They never have a wound dehiscence, but yet they're flagged. So the coding isn't really wrong, and nothing really happened to the patient, and so I'm kind of stuck. So what we've done is we've really tried to partner with ARC and give feedback about, you know, that maybe this measure needs a little tweak. And they have heard, I think, some of what we're talking about, and I'll let some of them chime in about how they continue to refine the measures. But I find just trying to share with them our findings, and they've been quite responsive to try to continue to improve the validity and accuracy of the measures. So I think they have a help desk. I've sent email questions into them, and they've been typically responsive. I don't know, Peter, if you want to have a comment, or Jan.
This is Jan. So Joanna and I work on the toolkit, and our technical experts on the QIs are not on the call.
but we encourage you to keep sending questions about that into the email address, or you can send them to Missy if you have any specific questions on the technical aspects of the QIs. You can send those to Missy, and I know she'll be sending those to us for our QI team to get back in touch with you on that.
Okay, thank you.
And once again, it's star one if you have a question, and we'll go to the next question.
Hello, this is Karen Allard from HSHS St. Vincent's Hospital. I have a question for Ellen, two things. If you find that in the documentation coding review that it was a wrong code or it was missing the exclusion criteria, since this is happening after billing, are then the cases rebilled?
Yeah, and so that was something that was a struggle at first, and I didn't mention that, but they didn't want to rebill anything, right? So that was a problem. And, again, I think that's where the leadership has had to say that, you know what, if it's not right, you should rebill it. And we've now actually, with just the work and talking through with them what the measures are, I probably only send them one a month at the most. I mean, the change just in the accuracy of our coding by having them understand the impact has been huge. But, yeah, they don't like to rebill, and so I think that you certainly need high-level support for somebody to be saying you are going to rebill these, because really, for them, they shouldn't, if it's not a real event, that it shouldn't be there. You know, I mean, it's a failure either way if they do it wrong.
Correct. That's something that we recently identified as something we need to work through on our end here. The other question that I had for you, I just wanted to make sure that you were rebilling, because I was hoping we were going the right way with what we're trying to do here. The other question that I had for you, one of the slides, you said that your finance department had associated a dollar amount with, the raw account differential times the dollars. Where did you come up with the dollar estimates for the different PSIs?
Well, as part of the original team with the UHC and the RAND Corporation, they did have just some ballpark figures in that spreadsheet to start, and I think that they did remove them because the variety was so different. So what we did some lit review. For example, our infection control team decided what the value of a CLABSI was going to be. There is some literature about the value of a DVT, and so we just kind of worked with finance and clinical people to come up with a number that was agreeable.
Okay, so it was an agreeable internal amount.
Exactly, across. Yeah, it really, because you're really just comparing your own self to your own self the next year, so as long as you really use the same cost, you know, you can kind of try to show a saving.
Great, thank you. That was all of my questions.
Just to add to that, this is Peter from RAND. We did try to provide that information. We found it was not helpful because the cost data we were able to provide had pretty low validity for a lot of the hospitals. So we determined it was better to just take that out of the toolkit and have hospitals use their own cost data. And as Ellen says, at least they're able to compare themselves to themselves.
Great. Thank you.
We'll take the next question.
Hi, Ellen. I'm calling from Virginia Mason Medical Center. My question is in regards to one of your earlier slides where you mentioned one of your focuses was to capture real-time data opposed to the lag of, I think you said, 6 weeks to 3 months. That slide's not up, so I'm not sure what the exact number was. How close to real-time did you get?
So I run it around the 10th of the month, so what's it today? And we could meet up for lunch. You're right down the street at Virginia Mason. So I run it around the 9th or the 10th of the month for the previous. So for November, I'll run November 10th, I'll run October.
Thank you.
One thing to know, too, so I think you might just talk with your coders, because depending on how many days behind they are, you could potentially run it faster than that. There are times in the month with our coders where they're already working. Everybody's on on November. All October is done. So, you know, depending on them, if they can give you the pass, like, yep, we're done, then you can run it and, you know, you'll have everything. So,
absolutely. Thanks again, Ellen.
And everyone, at this time, there are no further questions.
I want to thank everyone so much, including our guests from AHRQ and from RAN, and Ellen from Harborview Medical Center. If anyone had a question they didn't have a chance to ask or thinks of something after this presentation, You're welcome to email me directly at mdanforth@leapfroggroup.org. I'll pass your question on to the appropriate panel member and have them respond to you directly. In addition, we'll be sending out these presentation slides from all four presenters today, along with the recording, to all registrants, probably on Monday. It usually takes us a little while to get that recording back. I want to thank you all for joining us today, and again, thank you so much to our presenters. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.
Thanks very much.
Once again, ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude today's conference. Thank you all for your participation.